Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, we've got a very long chapter ahead of us today, and so you probably will have noticed that the 1 Kings 8 runs for some 66 verses. We don't intend to expound the chapter at length, but what we do hope to do is to try and encapsulate the key details of what happened on this particular day, and to perhaps lay the basis for some further study that you might like to undertake on a personal basis. The 1 Kings chapter 8, of course, is the chapter that brings us now to the dedication of the temple. You'll remember that our study yesterday took up the very first verse of the third chapter concerning Solomon's marriage, which we believe took place after the temple had been started in the fourth year of his reign. The temple, in fact, was built over a period of 7 years, and now we've come to the end of that seven-year period. Solomon has been married for probably at least several years, three or four as a minimum, and now the time has come after 7 long years of building the temple for its dedication to be accomplished. And the 1 Kings chapters 5 and 6 and 7 are detailing the story of the building of the temple, but it's not until chapter 8 that Solomon himself again appears in the story. And so we come now, by way of our next study, therefore, to the 8th chapter, where Solomon again is going to come before us in the narrative, and we have somewhat to speak concerning him. I think perhaps the best way to start is simply to run through what we've done here is simply put a summary of the order of events as they occurred on this day. You may wish to take a note of this afterwards. The overhead will be available down here for copying purposes. There is, of course, a record in the Book of Kings and also a parallel record in the Book of Chronicles. And there are one or two places where the records do slightly diverge. There is at least a couple of places where the Book of Chronicles has just a little more detail than the Book of Kings. We're going to use the Book of Kings still as our basis, but on the odd occasion we might move over to the Chronicles record. So you'll see that the story of the day began where the king and all the congregation preceded the ark to the Temple Mount. We're told that in the 1 Kings chapter 8 and verse 5. And so just before we get to verse 5, though, we just pick up the first four verses, and we're told in the 1 Kings chapter 8 and verse 1 that Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes and the chief of the fathers of the children of Israel unto King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh out of the city of David, which is in Zion. You'll remember, of course, that Zion was a little further down the hill. The temple area was further to the north and on a higher elevation. And so they're going to bring the Ark of the Covenant up out of the city of David. And verse 2 says that all the men of Israel assembled themselves unto King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. And the very fact that we're given the story of the month here is, I think, an indication of the magnitude of this particular event. If you come back to the 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, we're given these three interesting details concerning the building and the dedication of the temple. We're told, first of all, in the 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, that it came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziph, which is the second month, he began to build the house of Yahweh. So we're given the year and the month concerning the beginning of the building of the house. That's verse 1. When we come to verse 38, the final verse of the same chapter, chapter 6, verse 38, we're given the specific detail of the month of its completion. In the 11th year, in the month Bul, which is the 8th month, was the house finished throughout all the parts thereof. And now in chapter 8 and verse 2, we're given the specific timing of its dedication, and we're told there that they gathered themselves together to King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. So we're given the month that the temple was begun, we're given the month that the temple was completed, and we're given the month that the temple was dedicated. Do you know that the month and the years are not given that sort of detail since the children of Israel left Egypt in the days of the Exodus? It hasn't been since the time of the Exodus that the divine narrative has given us such specific detail of timing and month. But this was a significant epoch. The building and dedication of the temple. And as if to mark the magnitude of this whole matter, we're given the specific timing of this particular story. Actually, you'll notice that the record tells us in the 8th chapter that the temple was dedicated in the 7th month, and yet it said back in chapter 6 in verse 38 that the temple was actually finished in the 8th month. So how do we explain the dedication of the temple in the 7th month? Any ideas on that at all? If the temple wasn't completed till the 8th month, how did they manage to dedicate the temple in the 7th month? Sorry? Did they do it before it was finished? Yes, in other words, that's what I'm asking. All right. Any other thoughts on that at all? Well, I think that what they did was they actually waited till the next year. They finished it in the 11th year, in the 8th month, but you can imagine that the greatness of this occasion would demand a fair degree of planning. There'd be the organisation of the singers and of the priests and of the offerings that were going to be made and the order of events that day. And so I think what happened was they took, in fact, the next period of time right through to the 7th month of the following year before the dedication of the temple occurred. So we make the suggestion that although the temple was finished in the 11th year and in the 8th month, that its dedication, which we're looking at now in chapter 8 and verse 2, in fact didn't take place till the 7th month of the following year, which allowed ample time for good and adequate preparations for this momentous event to occur. And momentous it was, because we're told in verse 3 of the first of Kings 8, "And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of Yahweh, and the tabernacle of the congregation, and all the holy vessels that were in the tabernacle, even these did the priests and the Levites bring up." Now you see, when you read verses 3 and 4 carefully, what we're being told is that in fact there were two entirely different processions on that day. Because the ark of the covenant was coming from the city of David, which lay to the south. But the tabernacle of the congregation came from Gibeon, which lay to the north. And all the holy vessels of the tabernacle lay at Gibeon with the ancient tent from the days of the Exodus. So in fact, there were two processions that occurred on that day. One came winding down from the heights of Gibeon from the north and came down to the temple area, bearing the tabernacle of the congregation and the holy vessels, the brazen altar, the candlestick, the table of showbread, probably even the brazen serpent. They all came from the north down to the Temple Mount area. But up from the south, from the city of David, came the ark, of course, which David had placed in that area, having brought it up during the course of his own reign. And so the two processions came together and met, we believe, probably in the area of the Temple Mount itself. Now we might just have a look at that on another overhead here and just see what happened there for. Here we have essentially an outline of the temple area in the days of Solomon. This area to the south of the... this is the area of the temple. This area to the south was the royal palace compound. We're not suggesting, by the way, that we agree that that was necessarily the exact layout of the royal palace. The fact of the matter is we're not told and we don't know. This is simply a suggested outline, which is, includes the House of the Forest of Lebanon, the Porch of Pillars, the Porch of the Throne, the House for Pharaoh's Daughter, and that this whole area would belong to the king as his royal compound. And then to the north of that lay the temple area proper. Now what we're suggesting probably happened on this occasion was the ark came up from Zion and came up into the eastern entrance of the temple area and met there with the procession that had come down from the north bearing the tabernacle from Gibeon, and that the two processions met together in this eastern side of the temple that they might make their way across the temple compound and into the temple building. The ark, of course, was going to go into the temple area itself and into the most holy place. Where was the tabernacle going to go and the holy vessels? Where would they go? Any ideas on that? Well, they probably went, and we're not specifically told, but one would imagine that they probably went into this blue area around the temple, because there was a whole set of chambers known as the chambers of the priests that went right around the two sides and the rear of the temple of Solomon. And into those store chambers we believe that probably the relics of the tabernacle went, because that whole era of Israel's history was now brought to a conclusion. So the old vessels and the tabernacle, the remains of the tent would be packed up and placed into the chamber areas around the temple proper. So that's the scene, as it were, that we're confronted with here in the first of Kings chapter 8 and verses 3 and 4, as the two processions come to meet one another in the area of the outer and inner courts of the temple. We're told in verse 5 of this chapter, it says there that King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel that were assembled unto him were with him before the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen that could not be told or numbered for multitude. So what happened here is the king and the congregation actually entered the temple area before the ark itself. They went in front of the ark and they celebrated the transfer of the ark by the means of offering sacrifices. Can you remember anyone that did that? Anyone else that did that? Who else celebrated that same spirit of transferring the ark by going before it and offering sacrifices? Well, of course, that was David, wasn't it? That's exactly what David, Solomon's father, had done. And on that particular day, David enacted the role of a priest, didn't he? He danced before Yahweh with all his might, girt in a linen ephod, the symbol of the Melchizedek priesthood. Well, we believe that Solomon remembered that day from his father's life, and that there was going to be a deliberate taking up by Solomon now in this chapter of that same spirit of Melchizedek priestly function, as he likewise went before the ark and celebrated its removal by the offering of countless offerings here in the fifth verse. So that by the time the ark arrived in the holy place, the king was already there, and so were the people. What we're not told, however, in the book of Kings is that whilst we're told here that the king and all the congregation came before the ark, we're given another detail, which only the book of Chronicles tells us, that the king did something unique and special on this day. If you come to the second of Chronicles, chapter 6 and verse 13, we're told that on this day, Solomon, in fact, didn't just stand with the congregation. He had, in fact, built a special platform that he intended to use as his own place that he would stand during the course of the celebrations that day. Only the book of Chronicles actually gives us this detail. The second of Chronicles chapter 6 and verse 13 says, "For Solomon had made a brazen scaffold of 5 cubits long and 5 cubits broad and 3 cubits high, and had set it in the midst of the court, and upon it he stood." So you see, if we just put our chart on again, what happened here was, here we have the temple area, here we have the altar which was in front of the temple, and then we have this brazen scaffold that was especially erected by Solomon in the middle of the court area, but to the east of the altar. And the reason, we believe, why Solomon erected that was that it's going to tell us the leading position that the king intended to take on this day. He wanted to be seen by all the congregation. Where would the congregation be? Well, they could only be in one place. Where would that be? The congregation of Israel could only really be in one place. Where would that be? They'd have to be in the outer courts. Quite right, Mark. So the congregation filled this area here, no doubt, right around the courts, that they might witness the spectacle of this glorious day. In through the eastern entrance came the ark from the south and the tabernacle from the north, but before that had happened, the congregation had already assembled, and the king had made his own entrance and ascended onto the brazen scaffold that he'd erected. And there he stood in front of the temple, and on all sides about him and behind him was the congregation of Israel in the outer court. Because on that day, he wanted the nation to see him and also to be able to hear him, because he was going to offer the prayer of dedication on that day. Now, the interesting thing about this chapter is that on this day, the day of the dedication of the temple, we have a day of absolute priestly activity. And Zadok the priest is nowhere to be found. He's nowhere to be found in this record on this day. And yet it was a day absolutely full of priestly activity. But it was Solomon who became the priest on this day, and deliberately so, after the spirit of his father David, who danced before Yahweh girt in a linen ephod, as typical of the spirit of the Melchizedek priesthood. And so the brazen scaffold was erected, and Solomon, having made his entrance into the temple area, he ascended the brazen scaffold, and there he also awaited now the bringing of the ark in through the eastern entrance and across the floor of the inner court, and ultimately across to the tabernacle, to the temple rather, itself. So coming back to the book of Kings, and just taking up the record again, the 1st of Kings chapter 8, we're told that that's exactly what happened. It says in the 6th verse that the priests brought in the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh unto his place, into the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread forth their two wings over the place of the ark, and the cherubims covered the ark and the staves thereof above, and they drew out the staves, that the ends of the staves were seen out in the holy place before the oracle, and they were not seen without, and there they are unto this day. So what actually happened was, as the whole congregation stood there, and Solomon stood upon the brazen scaffold, the priests, the Kohathites, bearing the ark, came in through the eastern side. And they made their way across the court towards the temple. And as the nation gazed on, they all saw the Levites and the priests separating. The Levites stood to one side of the altar, while the priests proper carried on with the ark into the temple itself. And the whole nation, including Solomon, saw the ark disappear in through the door, under the porch, into the holy place, and of course ultimately into the most holy place itself. And there in the Holy of Holies were two giant guardians waiting to receive the ark. Because inside the holy place were two enormous cherubim that had been built by Solomon. They were so large that their wings outstretched touched either wall on the side of the holy place. They were enormous. And under the shadow of these two giant, new, overstretching cherubims, The Ark of the Covenant was brought in and placed underneath their shadow in this whole box of the Holy of Holies that we're told in the 1st of Kings chapter 6 and verses 20 to 22 was completely lined with gold. Must have been an absolutely awe-inspiring spectacle as far as the priests were concerned, and the whole nation stood outside waiting, watching, the king standing upon the platform also waiting to see what would happen on this occasion. Well, we're told what happened, because verse 10 says, "It came to pass, when the priests were come out of the holy place, that the cloud filled the house of Yahweh, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of Yahweh had filled the house of Yahweh. And then spake Solomon and said that Yahweh said that he would dwell in the thick darkness." Why do you think they drew out the staves in verse 8? Why did they draw the staves out? Well, I think we're given a clue in the 1st of Chronicles chapter 23, verses 25 and 26. You see, the building of the temple marked a new era in the history of the nation. And that is that the time of absolute rest had now been given. There was no longer a tabernacle. There was now a permanent dwelling place for God. And in the first of Chronicles 23, in verses 25 and 26, it says, "For David said, Yahweh Elohim of Israel hath given rest unto his people, that they may dwell in Jerusalem for ever, and also unto the Levites, they shall no more carry the tabernacle, nor any vessels of it for the service thereof." And as if to symbolize, therefore, that the carrying or journeying days of the ark were now finally over, when the priest took the ark into the most holy place on this occasion, they drew the staves out from the rings, as if to say, here indeed is now the final resting place of the ark. The priest shall no longer carry it thence. The time of its permanent abode has now come to pass. And one can imagine the tremendous excitement that must have been there in the outer courts as the king stood silent upon the scaffold, and out came the priests, having gone inside with the ark. We in fact need to move to the book of Chronicles just for a moment, because we're told that as the priests withdrew, the temple choir burst into praise. And again, only the book of Chronicles gives us this account. In the second of Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 11, we have the identical opening phrase to this section as in the book of Kings. "It came to pass when the priests were come out." That's exactly what King says. But Chronicles goes on to say, in the first of Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 12, "Also the Levites, which were the singers, all of them of Asaph, of Heman, of Jeduthun, and their sons and their brethren, being arrayed in white linen, having cymbals and psalteries and harps, stood at the east end of the altar, and with them 120 priests sounding with trumpets. And it came even to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one, to make one sound to be heard in praising and thanking Yahweh. And when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music, and praised Yahweh, saying, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever, that then the house was filled with a cloud." So you see, what actually happened was, just taking up those two records together, was the priest went in with the ark into the most holy place, and the king stood outside waiting. And as they had gone across this area here, no doubt around the king on either the north or south side, the Levites separated themselves from the priests, and they in fact stood on this eastern side of the altar, immediately between the altar and the king. And they stood there with all their musical instruments and the trumpets and the choir. The whole of the Levite group stood here in between the king and the altar, whilst the priests proper went into the holy place in order that they might deposit the ark. And no doubt what happened, you see, was all the singers and the trumpeters were there, all waiting. And as they saw the priests come out of the porch area again, that was the cue for the choir to burst into praise and for the musical instruments to begin. But as they began to sing, and as they began to praise, and Solomon standing behind them all of a sudden, we're told that this enormous, thick darkness of a cloud came billowing forth to betoken the fact that the divine presence had indeed arrived, and that the divine endorsement had been given to this grand moment when the ark had been taken into its final resting place. Now, can you imagine Can you imagine how Solomon must have felt on that occasion? Look, he must have been absolutely excited. And I think we can capture that. If you come back to the first of Kings chapter 8, you can almost sense Solomon just about stuttering in his excitement here. Because, you see, what happens is, verse 11 of the first of Kings 8 says, "So the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of Yahweh filled the house. And then spake Solomon, Yahweh said that he would dwell in thick darkness. I've surely built thee a house to dwell in, a settled place for thee to abide in forever." Solomon was absolutely overcome by that moment. He was absolutely thrilled. He couldn't help himself from saying something. He was just so excited. And I think, that's a good insight into the king, because we don't know much about this man, do we? But he was a man that could be touched by the feelings of the moment. And I'm sure he was touched on this occasion. And you see what he then did. Most interesting, verse 14. "The king turned his face and blessed all the congregation of Israel, and all the congregation stood." So you see, the fact that it tells us that he turned his face, it tells us, of course, that up to this point of time, he's been standing on the brazen scaffold facing the temple, watching the priests go into the place. He sees them coming out. He sees the choir in front of him bursting into praise. He sees the cloud, the sign of the cloud. He can't stop himself from saying that Yahweh said he would dwell in thick darkness. And then he turns around now and blesses the congregation that are, of course, on each side of him and to the rear. Now, the interesting thing about that, of course, is, well, come and have a look at Numbers chapter 6. By the way, we're not told the words that he used in the book of Kings. The words that follow are certainly not the blessing of the people, although it was something else that he said. We're not given in the record of Kings the actual words that he used for the blessing of the people. But you'll remember that the most famous record of the blessing of the people is in Numbers 6 and verse 22. It says, Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, saying, On this wise shall ye bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, Yahweh bless thee and keep thee, Yahweh make his face shine upon thee, and be gracious unto thee, Yahweh lift up his countenance upon thee, and give thee shalom. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. And maybe it was the very words of the blessing of Numbers 6 that Solomon now bestowed as a benediction upon all the congregation that stood about him. But you see the point of Numbers, it was the priest's job to bless the nation, not the king's. Speak unto Aaron and his sons, saying, Ye shall bless the children of Israel. But it's Solomon who undertakes that work on this occasion. As he stands upon the brazen platform, he turns around and faces the congregation, and he blesses the congregation of Israel. You see, he's taking up the whole function of priesthood deliberately on this day. And so coming back to the record then of Kings, we have that following on from the time when the king turned and blessed the congregation, and you'll notice that they all stood up to receive it. So they must have kneeled down, probably at the time that the music burst into praise and the sign of the thick darkness arrived. The whole congregation went down on their knees. And Solomon said, Yahweh said he would dwell in thick darkness, and then as he turns around to bless the congregation, they all stand up before the king in acknowledgement of his majesty, and he then bestows the priestly blessing upon the congregation. And having done that, we believe that what Solomon then did was he turned back to the temple, he kneeled down with his hands outstretched and offered the formal prayer of dedication. Now that takes us to verse 22 of the first of Kings 8. It says there that Solomon stood before the altar of Yahweh in the presence of all the congregation of Israel and spread forth his hands toward heaven. Now you'll notice that verse 22 doesn't tell us that he kneeled down, but verse 54 does. Because if you come over the page to verse 54, at the end of the prayer of dedication, it says, It was so that when Solomon had made an end of praying all this prayer and supplication unto Yahweh, he arose from before the altar of Yahweh, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread up to heaven. And the book of Chronicles tells us likewise that that is indeed what he did. Now, can you just imagine the feelings of the king on this occasion? They've witnessed the ark coming into the place. They've seen the token of the divine acknowledgement. He's turned around and blessed the congregation, and now he's about to offer the formal prayer of dedication. And Solomon is so moved at the spirit of what was going to happen on this occasion that he just sinks down on his knees. Can you just see that happening? I can just see that. He just collapses to his knees and lifts his hands out to heaven. I tell you what, brothers and sisters, I bet you didn't see anyone else there at that time. The congregation didn't exist for Solomon at that moment. His whole focus was on his prayer to Yahweh, the God of heaven, concerning this moment, which was indeed the climax, really, of his life in terms of what he was going to accomplish. And look at what he said in verse 23. He said, well, let's have a look at what he says. Maybe we should just have a look at the prayer in a bit more detail. Again, we haven't got time to comment on the prayer in specific detail, but there is just a couple of interesting highlights that we ought to take out of the record of the prayer. So here is the story of the prayer of dedication. There are three main sections to the prayer. There is an introductory section which starts here in the 23rd verse of Kings and goes through to verse 30. It's the theme of those verses is the praise of Yahweh, whose dwelling place is in the heavens. You see verse 30. This is a key, and it comes all the way through the balance of this prayer. You see in the 1st of Kings 8, verse 30, it says there, "And hearken thou to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel when they shall pray towards this place, and hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place." Now, you see how that contrasts with what Solomon said in verses 12 and 13. Yahweh said that he would dwell in thick darkness, and I have built thee a dwelling place. But you see, when Solomon lifts up his voice now to offer the prayer of dedication, and by the way, when you look at the prayer, it's absolutely clear that this was not a spontaneous prayer. This was thoroughly and absolutely prepared by Solomon, especially for this occasion. Oh, he'd worked long and hard on this prayer, in terms of gathering together the thoughts that he wanted to express on this day. Now you see what he says in verse 30. He's just said that Yahweh is going to dwell in the thick darkness in the house that he's built from on the earth. But for all the glory of the house that he'd built, Solomon's first acknowledgement in this prayer is that he knows that Yahweh really dwells in heaven. As he says, verse 27, "Will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee. How much less this house that I have built." And that's the key phrase, verse 30, "Hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place." That's the key phrase that now occurs time and time again throughout the whole prayer. Solomon wasn't deceived by the grandeur of the building, brothers and sisters. He knew that whatever the greatness was of what they'd accomplished on this day, that Yahweh, the God of Israel, dwells in heaven, always has done, always will do. And that it was the heaven that he addressed his prayer, although he acknowledged gratefully the symbol of the divine presence that had been placed here on earth in the form of the thick cloud. And having given that opening burst of praise in that prayer, what Solomon then did was prayed for every single thing he could think of. That Yahweh might judge in disputes, that he might help the nation to recover from defeat in battle, that in time of distress he might bless them with rain, that he might restore them from the affliction of plagues and of illness that might come upon the nation, that he would hear the prayer of the stranger that might be cried towards him, that he would strengthen Israel in time of battle, and that were they to be taken into captivity, that even there, cast off the land, that he would succor them and have compassion upon them. And Solomon brought together here a prayer of petition, whereby he asked for the divine favour on everything he could think of, every possible circumstance that might befall the nation. But there was a key that had to be performed. And the key was, well, let's have a look at a couple of them. Verse 31, here's the first one, to judge in disputes. "If any man trespass against his neighbour, and an oath be laid upon him to cause him to swear, and the oath come before thine altar in this house, then hear thou in heaven." So if the man swore an oath concerning his innocence towards this house, then hear thou in heaven. Verse 33, "When thy people Israel are smitten down, if they turn and pray and make supplication unto thee towards this house, then hear thou in heaven." Verse 35, "If the heaven is shut up and there's no rain, if they pray towards this place, then hear thou in heaven." And so Solomon now gave a sense of focus to the nation, that he asked the nation that they might address their prayers directed towards the God of the presence who dwelt in the holy place of the temple, and that if they could direct their prayers to God concerning the most holy place, that in fact it would elicit a response from God who really dwelt in the heavens above, but they would pray to his dwelling place upon the earth, in order that they might receive the response from he who dwelt in the heavens. It's a very structured and orderly prayer, this one. There's nothing vague or casual about it. Bear in mind, of course, we've got nothing against spontaneous prayers. There are many times and circumstances when spontaneous prayer is very suitable. But on this occasion, it was such an important day that it wasn't good enough to simply get up and speak, you know, in terms of what he might have just thought out of the moment of his heart. There was something very planned and organized about this prayer of dedication. And notice this one in the middle here, to answer the stranger. The first of Kings chapter 8 verse 41. Moreover, concerning a stranger that is not of thy people Israel, but cometh out of a far country for thy name's sake, for they shall hear of thy great name. Nice to think, isn't it? The king perhaps turning and smiling at his queen. Who was such a stranger? And who had come to this place? Because he had heard of Yahweh's great name. Yes, says Solomon, hear the prayer of he who is not a Jew, of whom his wife, Gentile and Egyptian, had been the prototype of all those who in the age to come would come and be able to pray to Yahweh, the God of Israel, and to know that he would hear their prayers. There was no Jewish exclusiveness in what Solomon was praying for here. It was his desire that all nations might be enfolded into the loving embrace of the God of heaven. And his own wife, of course, was the prototype of that, wasn't she? And then finally, having pleaded that Yahweh might always remember his people, we're given a final prayer that only again the book of Chronicles records. You might just turn to that because it's quite interesting. There's a little dilemma created for us here. In the second of Chronicles chapter 6 and verses 40 and 42, right at the end of the prayer, we have some detail now that only is given to us in the book of Chronicles, and you might like to see if you can work out where this comes from. Now my God, second of Chronicles 6 verse 40, let I beseech thee thine eyes be open, and let thine ears be attent unto the place that is prayer that is made in this place. Now therefore arise, O Yahweh God, into thy resting place, thou and the ark of thy strength. He talks about the priests and about the saints and about his anointed, and God remembering each and every one of them. Now, where do the words of the second of Chronicles 6 verses 40 and 42 come from? Does anybody know? Where do those words come from? Or, sorry, I should be careful there. I shouldn't presuppose anything. Perhaps I should say, where else do we hear these words? Not specifically, no. It's more, well, I suppose there is a spirit of Psalm 68 and Isaiah 62, but verses 41 and 42 are specifically drawn from another passage or specifically found in another passage. Does anyone know where that is? Arise into thy resting place, thou and the ark of thy strength, let thy priests be clothed with salvation, let thy saints rejoice in goodness. Where does all that come from? Where else is that found? Yes, Psalm 132. Now, this creates a little problem for us, because if you come to Psalm 132, it's one of the songs of degrees. Well, well, well. So this is one of the psalms that was brought into the degrees of Hezekiah, and yet we find these words coming out of the mouth of Solomon at the dedication of the temple. Now, the great issue, of course, concerning Psalm 132 is, who wrote it? Well, you see, it's been suggested that it's a psalm of David concerning the removing of the ark. And you'll notice that it says in verse 8, arise, O Yahweh, into thy rest, thou and the ark of thy strength, let thy priests be clothed, let thy saints shout for thy servant David's sake, turn not away the face from thine anointed. And these words are now coming out of the mouth of Solomon at the prayer of the dedication. Now here's the choice you have. If David wrote this psalm, then Solomon is deliberately quoting his father. But if David didn't write the psalm, then it is most likely that Solomon wrote the psalm, in which case Hezekiah is probably quoting Solomon and works it into the Songs of Degrees. Actually, both ideas are sort of attractive in their way. My inclination is that David did in fact write Psalm 132. It's been suggested that he didn't, because it says, for example, you know, for thy servant David's sake, verse 10, or verse 17, I'll make the horn of David to bud, and that one couldn't imagine David saying that about himself. But I think that how the psalm is written, of course, is that David makes prayer and Yahweh answers it. So when Psalm 132 says, I'll make the horn of David to bud, it's actually the divine answer coming back to the earlier part of the psalm, which is David's prayer. In fact, you'll notice what it says in Psalm 132, verse 8. Arise, O Yahweh, into thy rest, thou in the ark of thy strength. Let thy priests be clothed with righteousness. Let thy saints shout for joy. Turn not away from the face of thine anointed. Now, that's David's part of the prayer of the psalm. If you come to the later part of the psalm, here we have Yahweh's comments when he says in verse 13, Yahweh has chosen Zion. He has desired it. This is my rest. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it. I will abundantly bless her provision. I will satisfy her poor. I will clothe her priests. I will cause her saints to shout aloud for joy. So the second part of Psalm 132 is God's answer to David's prayer. But it is undoubtedly written concerning the removing of the ark into its resting place. Now, if David did write that psalm, then what a wonderfully appropriate psalm for Solomon to use to conclude his prayer at the dedication. The very psalm that his father wrote concerning the bringing of the ark into its resting place, and Solomon quotes those words. Notice also the interesting use of that, therefore, in verses 17 and 18, the last two verses of the psalm, because the psalm goes on to say, and here's God's answer, you see, there will I make the horn of David, that's Solomon, to bud. And that word bud means to sprout. It's the word from whence the word branch comes, my servant the branch. I will make the horn of David to sprout. I have ordained a lamp for mine anointed, which is Solomon on this occasion. His enemies will I clothe with shame, but upon himself shall his crown flourish. Now the word crown in Psalm 132 verse 18 is the word used of the priestly crown that went on the top of the high priest's mitre. Exodus chapter 29 verse 6, Exodus chapter 39 verse 30, Leviticus 8 verse 9, Leviticus 21 verse 12. It's used of the high priest's crown. It's the same word used throughout the book of the law concerning the consecration or the priestly separation of the Levite. So the answer of this prayer in response to Solomon saying, arise into thy rest, thou in the ark of thy strength, is that the divine response comes back saying, yes, I will do that. Yes, I have chosen Zion. Yes, I will clothe her priests with salvation. Yes, I will cause the horn of David, Solomon, to sprout, and upon his head shall the priestly crown flourish. And this is the day when the priestly crown indeed was to flourish upon the head of Solomon. That is the day of the dedication of the temple. Now, how appropriate that he should quote from that psalm on that occasion as he brings this magnificent prayer to a conclusion, standing, or rather kneeling, I should say, shouldn't I? Kneeling on the brazen scaffold that he'd built that day. So coming back to the book of Kings then, we find, well no, you better not do that, because Chronicles actually tells us something that occurred after that, which again only Chronicles gives us, in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 7. In the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 7 and verse 1, the Chronicles record says, now when Solomon had made an end of praying, the fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of Yahweh filled the house, and the priests could not enter into the house of Yahweh because of the glory of Yahweh had filled Yahweh's house. And when all the children of Israel saw how the fire came down and the glory of Yahweh upon the house, they bowed themselves with their faces to the ground upon the pavement and worshipped and praised Yahweh, saying, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever. Can you just see that sight that day?
as the king finally brings his prayer to a conclusion, almost overcome with emotion, sinking onto his knees, his hand out. It was a tremendously long prayer, wasn't it? It went on and on and on, but it was the outpouring of all of Solomon's thoughts. And he finally concludes with that wonderful prayer out of the lips of his own father, bearing in mind the divine response of that psalm concerning the priestly crown that might flourish upon his own head. And as he finishes his prayer and his hands come down, there's a flash of fire and the mark of the glorious presence, and the whole congregation bow down their faces to the ground, awestruck at the sight of the divine presence. And the what a spirit there must have been on that day. How would you feel if you were Solomon? That Yahweh had answered your prayer in such a way as to indicate that he was indeed pleased with what had happened on this occasion. Verse 4 of Chronicles tells us, "Then the king and all the people offered sacrifices before Yahweh, and King Solomon offered a sacrifice of 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep, so the king and all the people dedicated the house of God." It was a wonderful, a highly spiritual, and the highlight of Solomon's work to this point of time. If you come back to the first of Kings then, in chapter 8, we're told in the latter verses of the chapter, which is actually the verses that we took as our reading from verses 54 to the end of the chapter, we're told that verse 54 says, "When Solomon made an end of praying all this prayer and supplication, he arose from the altar of Yahweh, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread up to heaven, and he stood and blessed all the congregation of Israel with a loud voice." And so again, he actually blessed the congregation for a second time. And then in verse 62 it says, "The king and all Israel with him offered sacrifices." And verse 64 tells us, "The same day did the king hallow the middle of the court that was before the house of Yahweh, for there he offered burnt offerings and meat offerings and the fat of peace offerings, because the brazen altar that was before Yahweh was too little to receive the multitude of offerings." And then finally, verse 65 tells us that at that time Solomon held a feast and all Israel with him. What was the feast they held, by the way, at the end of the first of Kings chapter 8? It was one of the ordinary feasts. Which one was it? Well, it would have to be Tabernacles, wouldn't it? Because remember, we've been told in the second verse that they assemble together in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. So they've held the feast of the dedication of the altar 7 days, and that has now brought them to the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. And so the 7 days that then followed were in fact the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. And what an appropriate feast that should be held at this time, because what did the Feast of Tabernacles celebrate? It celebrated the time when God had cared for the nation, when they yet dwelt in tents or tabernacles. And now there is a temple built for God, and it stood there complete in all its permanent glory. If ever there was a sign of the divine blessing as it now rested upon them, it was in the form of the temple that stood before their gaze. And the Feast of Tabernacles also, of course, was celebrated to give thanks to God for the final ingathering of all the harvest at the end of each year. And it celebrates the time when the Gentiles will be gathered into the Abrahamic fold. So which feast will be held under the auspices of the king priest of the age to come? And the answer is, of course, after the prototype of Solomon here. We're told, aren't we, in Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 16, that all nations shall go up to worship the king and to keep the feast of tabernacles in the day of the kingdom. And just as Solomon brought his own dedicatory service here to an end with the maintenance and observance of the Feast of Tabernacles, so also Christ as a king priest in the age to come will in fact encourage the nations to come up and assemble before him that they might keep the Feast of Tabernacles in the kingdom age. That's not just mentioned in Zechariah 14 and verse 16. We're also told in Ezekiel 45 and verse 25 that that will occur. Now let's just summarise where we are then with regard to what Solomon has done this day. You see, everything he's done has been to enact the role of a king priest. He has assembled the heads of the nation for the ceremony. It's the king who accompanies the ark on its ascent from Zion. It's the king who bestows the blessing on the congregation. It's the king who presents the prayer of dedication. It's the king who leads the nation in the offering of the sacrifices. It's the king who consecrates the middle of the court that offerings might be made. And it's the king who celebrates the keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles on this occasion. He is absolutely and thoroughly the king priest of the day. Deliberately so. And I believe that Solomon was taking up the spirit, as it were, of prophecy on this occasion. He knew what he was doing. And what Solomon was doing on this day, as his father David had done on an earlier occasion, and maybe he also wore an ephod on the day, who knows, he was taking up the spirit of prophecy, and what he was saying was that he who would be king of Salem, Solomon, would also be priest of the Most High God. That's Genesis, isn't it? And the teaching on Melchizedek. That he who was king of Salem or peace, that's Solomon, would also be priest of the Most High God. That's the teaching of the Melchizedek priesthood drawn from Genesis chapter 14. And Solomon says, that's me on this occasion. And he took up that role and played it to its fullest with a joyous spirit of thanksgiving before his God on that occasion. There was no presumption on Solomon's part on this occasion. And the very fact that the fire came down to witness to his prayer is proof enough that God thoroughly endorsed not only the prayers of Solomon on that occasion, but the spirit whereby he took up the role of the Melchizedek priesthood. So, let's have a look at our Bible echoes then concerning what occurred on this day. It's quite interesting, actually. If you're in the 1st of Kings chapter 8, you might just come back to verse 11 and notice a deliberate contrast that occurs here between verses 11 to 14. It says, or perhaps verse 10, "It came to pass when the priests were come out of the holy place that the cloud filled the house of Yahweh so that the priests could not stand to minister." Verse 12, "Then spake Solomon," verse 14, "and the king turned his face about and blessed all the congregation." So you see, in the space of just four verses, we're told that the Levitical priests could not minister. But the king then turns around and blesses the congregation as a priest. He could minister on that day. On the very day when the Levitical priesthood found that they could not attend to their responsibilities. Now that, of course, is Paul's teaching in Hebrews 7, isn't it, on the life of Melchizedek. So here we have that the Levitical priests could not stand to minister, and yet on the day when they could not do so, Solomon turned his face and blessed the congregation of Israel. And Paul says in Hebrews, "If therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, what further need was there that a different priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek? For he of whom these things are spoken pertaineth to another tribe. For it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah, of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. But Solomon spake something concerning priesthood, and he had sprung out of Judah, and he became the prototype of what Paul takes up in the book of Hebrews concerning a different priest that would arise because of the inability of the Levitical priesthood to bring the nation to maturity. And that was all foreshadowed, I believe, on this day. Marvellous. And Paul's teaching in Hebrews is endorsed by the experience of the Levitical priesthood in contrast to Solomon on the day of the dedication of the temple. No surprise, therefore, that when we come to the new temple of the kingdom age and to the book of Ezekiel, we come to the great temple that is yet to be built, and we find that the hero or the champion of the prophecy of Ezekiel's temple, well, what's his name? He's described as the prince, isn't he? And what does the prince do? Well, concerning Solomon, we read here in the 1st of Kings 8 that the king offered burnt offerings, meat offerings, peace offerings, and held the feast for 7 days. And when we come to the book of Ezekiel in the 45th chapter concerning the temple of the age to come, we're told it shall be the prince's part to prepare meat offerings, burnt offerings, peace offerings, and to do so in the feast of the 7 days. So the prince of the nation will also be its priest, according to Ezekiel 45. That spirit was first foreshadowed on the day of the dedication of the temple, when Solomon did exactly that. And the Lord's work as the king and as the priest in the age to come in fulfilment of Ezekiel 45 will be modelled on that earlier occasion of Solomon's work in this 8th chapter here. And what about this one here? Can you think of any other famous passages on the king-priest? What other passages spring to mind? I just need something to cover this up a bit. Hang on a tick. Okay. Do you remember this one here? Zechariah chapter 6. Behold the man whose name is the branch, and he shall sprout up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of Yahweh. Even he shall build the temple of Yahweh, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both. Now that teaching in the book of Zechariah must surely be based upon the life's experiences of Solomon. We're told in the 1st of Kings chapter 6 and verse 2, the house which Solomon built for Yahweh. He shall build the temple of Yahweh, is the teaching of Zechariah. The man who builds the temple will also be the priest, says Zechariah. And that's exactly Solomon's experience, isn't it? The man who built the temple also presided as its priest on the day of its dedication. And remember that word in Psalm 132? There will I make the horn of David to sprout, and his priestly crown shall flourish. He shall sprout up out of his place. Same word in Zechariah's prophecy. The man who is the branch that sprouts up from under David. Now, of course, it's Messiah, isn't it? Zechariah's teaching is concerning Messiah. But it's obviously modelled on Solomon, who built the temple and officiated at its opening ceremony. And you see what it says concerning the kingly and the priestly roles here. He shall rule upon his throne, he shall be a priest upon his throne, and the council of Solomon shall be between them both. There's obviously a play on Solomon's name there, isn't there? The NIV translates that, by the way, the council of harmony shall be between them both. In other words, the teaching of Zechariah is that there will be a perfect understanding that will exist between the kingly and the priestly roles. Why? Because they will all be in the person of one individual. And that's what the world needs. The whole problem with the world has long been, hasn't it? Civil rulers who lack any understanding of divine principles. Or of people who have divine principles but no ability to implement them in the form of government. That's exactly the dilemma that will be resolved by the king-priest of the age to come. When every circumstance of life and of civil life will be regulated by the divine principles that a priest understands about. A king and a priest brought together. That's exactly what the world needs. And that's exactly what the world shall receive when the temple is built. And the man who presides over its building, the man with the measuring reed, will also become its high priest and its king, and will rule over the nations and be a priest unto them as well. You know, we often talk about the Melchizedek priesthood, and we struggle, I think, to think about that. We think, well, how do we actually build that into life today itself? How do we become kings and priests? Well, you know, distilled into its most essential form, isn't the spirit of the Melchizedek priesthood simply this? That those who shall be with the king priest of the age to come are those that have learnt to take divine principles, priesthood, and to practice them in every aspect of daily life, government, kingship. Isn't that in its simplest form what the Melchizedek priesthood is all about? Isn't that how we prepare? That everything we do in daily life, however great or small, we seek to have it governed by divine principles. We seek to do that which is right according to the truth. We seek to find some guidance in the Word for whatever dilemma we face, in the practical necessities of life. Isn't that the spirit of king priesthood, bringing those two sides of life together? You know, even in that respect, brothers and sisters, if that's all we manage to do every day is to try and live according to divine principles, we are in measure preparing for that priestly role in the age to come, when the greater than Solomon shall be here, when a greater temple shall be built, when a more wonderful opening ceremony shall yet be performed, and when the glorious presence of God shall be seen not merely by the fire or the cloud, but in the congregation itself, who shall all be Elohim of the age to come, and not only Elohim, but kings and priests, together with their Lord, and all after the gracious order of Melchizedek.